It's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Norman Bloom has been dead for a year. He died of a heart attack. He was 67 years old, a homeless New Jersey man, mentally unstable, who found comfort in numbers. We introduced you to Norman Bloom last year in a lighthearted way. Bloom described for us the connection between the Baltimore Orioles' infamous 21-game losing streak and the divine will.
After Bloom's death, commentator Bob Garfield began to look deeper into the man's life and into the lives of his family and friends.
This must be 207. 62J, 195, 207. At long last, three numbers that really count for Norman Bloom. The man's affinity for arithmetic isn't apt to be equaled, yet never have a few homely digits meant so much to his life. In fact, they mark the end of it. The numbers belong to safe deposit boxes in a Paterson, New Jersey bank. Here, Bloom's children sit with a state examiner to inventory the numerological ephemera he deemed worthy of a Mosler vault. Now they constitute his meager legacy.
$10 counts. These are probably closed.
No, they're not.
March 83, I don't know if it's still active or not. Might be that they've been transferred.
It's possible.
Yeah.
He wasn't your basic normal person.
No, Norman Bloom was not your basic normal person. He was an eccentric mathematician, composer, and part-time ice cream truck driver whose last 26 years were a tortured messianic odyssey. It was a search, as he once explained, for the relationship between numbers and God.
He delights in correlating the number of the occurrence with the number of the date. This is done in all areas. It's done in the stock market. Dow Jones averages on 5-3 is plus 15. 5 times 3 equals 15. On the third day of the third month of the third year, that's March 3rd, 1983, the Dow Jones changes 3.00. How can blind accident correlate this occurrence, which results from the buying and selling of millions of shares of stock, on the idea of the date? You have to have a thinking, knowing creator having the power and the wish to do this.
That's just a taste of the Bloom proof, which in its fullest form encompasses biblical text, the Apollo space program, and the partition of Palestine, to say nothing of the Earth's orbit, the date of his circumcision, and the run-scoring punch of the Baltimore Orioles. For nearly three decades, he devoted all of his resources to publishing and proselytizing his theory of divine numbers play, forsaking the comforts of home and hearth for a life on the street. Bloom was sour-smelling and disheveled. He slept in his car. He was, in short, a vagrant, but an anonymous vagrant he was not. Carl Sagan, the astronomer, wrote about the Bloom proof, and millions of late-night radio listeners knew Bloom affectionately as the numbers man.
You're listening to The Larry King Show, live from the nation's capital. Here again, Larry King.
Yes, here again. Paramus, New Jersey. Hello.
Hello, Mr. King. You hear me?
Yeah.
Fine. I issued this challenge to Dr. Sagan, Dr. Teller, Dr. Jeremy Bernstein.
What's the challenge?
The challenge is that I issued that challenge that they should either prove me an error and win a prize.
Why did they have to prove you an error?
Pardon?
Why should they bother to prove you an error?
I'm giving you...
You deal with numbers. Why should they bother with that?
Pardon, sir?
Why should they bother with numbers?
Because, sir, if they didn't bother with numbers, you'd have no nuclear energy. The very discovery of the...
But if you told... If you could
For King's listeners, the numbers man was irrational and pathetic, but just entertaining enough to put up with. If they wondered how he came to be that way, they got no clues. If they envisioned him as somehow always having been a ranting monomaniac, they couldn't have been more wrong.
He was a very charming gift of gab and good-looking and talented and fun, bright, and very interesting man.
Terry Hulley, now a publishing executive, married 23-year-old Norm Bloom in 1944 and lived with him for 14 years.
He could whistle whole pieces of classical music through. From one end to the other, we would go to concerts all the time, and he would be ecstatic and into the music and very involved in the music, very talented man.
Or as his cousin Iris Kaplan puts it,
he was just a beautiful, beautiful human being. There was something about him that was almost spiritual. And how he reverted to this kind of a mishigas, and I don't know what else to call it, I will never know.
How and why did it all unravel? Terry and Norman were a happy couple with a baby daughter, a piece of the family floor coverings business, and a bright 50s suburban future. But there were pressures, too. Norman's upbringing had been rigid, verging on cruel, by a father who wished to live the cultured academic life vicariously through his children. Sam Bloom was a volatile tyrant. Norman's younger brother Jack, a practicing clinical psychologist, recalls.
My father was a very, very driven, in some ways rigid, but in some ways wanting his sons to have all the culture that was denied him. Norman would have to be up at 6:30 in the morning to practice piano, would go to public school. Right? Three times a week would go to Hebrew school. The other three, he would go to a Yiddish atheist school. My father used to brag about the fact that he would take Norman and Saul when they were a very little kid, 6 years old, to the organ concerts at the City College, and how quietly they would sit. He was very proud of it. They were probably scared out of their gourds.
Even as an adult, Norm was overwhelmed with his father's looming presence. When he and Terry broke away to start their own linoleum business and Bloom rented their first store, Sam Bloom interceded with the landlord to unrent it. By the mid-50s, ordinary marriage strains gave way to erratic behavior. One night, Bloom awoke, screaming, "Leave me alone, go away." He would seize on strange money-making schemes, such as one to implant plastic-encased girly images into pencils. Norm invested heavily and unsuccessfully, sending the floor business spiraling into bankruptcy and Bloom into further distress.
He would disappear. He wouldn't come home at night. He had episodes of, I guess, paranoia, schizophrenia. And finally, there was one episode where he got involved with a woman and police called me or somebody called me and it got just too bad and I said, "No, it's enough. You gotta go."
They separated in 1958, by which time their second child, Roger, was two. Bloom had been a worrisome husband, but he was one terrific weekend father. For Marcia and Roger, every Sunday was an adventure, frequently a musical one. The piano training Bloom had forced on him, he shared lovingly with his children in the form of songs of his own composition.
Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Sunday weekday mornings, weekday evenings, weekday afternoons. All I do is dream of Sunday.
I mean, my father was embarrassing to both my brother and I because he was loud and noisy and generous, and he would talk to strangers on the street, and he would ignore no trespassing signs.
Marcia Hulley.
There was also this incredible love. I mean, we grew up singing Walt Whitman. Me imperturbed, standing at ease in nature, master of all or mistress of all.
Me imperturbed, standing at ease in nature, master of all or mistress of all. A plum in the midst of irrational things.
This recording, sung by a baritone Bloom engaged to make a record, documents a turning point in his state of mind. In 1962, he hired Carnegie Recital Hall to give a concert, one which he said would vindicate and validate what had become his preoccupation with the Bible.
Finding my occupation.
The music was impressive, but almost nobody showed up, and Bloom was shattered. The anguish and humiliation, his brother thinks, marked the final blow, as if in one stroke he forever lost his grip on reality. Jack Bloom reads from a note his brother scribbled on a program after the ill-fated concert had ended.
My dear brother, I guess you are right, and I am the fool. No critics, no audience except friends and relatives, even though I distributed 1,600 tickets. This will probably change many things for me, but one thing will not change. He is my rock, my shield, and my strength. In him do I place my trust, your loving brother, Norm.
The odyssey had begun. The passion for music, entwined with a fixation for the Bible, gradually gave way to a singular fascination with numbers. In early 1962, sister-in-law Helen Blum recalls him scribbling license plate numbers for future reference. He squirreled away dollar bills with significant serial numbers. He got arrested in New York City in an incident involving a number on a subway turnstile. The disintegration continued, until in 1965, she and Blum's brothers contrived to get him help.
I couldn't believe that Norman was just going to be mad all his life. That was it. I just couldn't accept it. And somehow, I convinced them to have him committed, actually by hiding in the bushes or something near their home with someone from the state institution.
But he was out soon enough. Like many a schizophrenic, totally persuaded of his sanity, he refused all treatment. And because he was articulate and gentle and no physical threat to anybody, he was released, as he was from several other hospitalizations through the next 20 years. However, as my chat with him in mid-1988 revealed, nonviolent is one thing and mentally healthy is quite another. He had been going on about the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, when I realized what he was getting at.
Are you the Messiah?
Yes, this is who I am, sir. This is definitely who I am. This was made known to me in 1962. There was an anointing without human hands of sacramental wine. I am Mashiach ben David HaMelech. I am the one who fulfills this. I am the one who reveals the power of God and teaches mankind and brings a new world for mankind. This is my purpose.
Yes, Norman Blum, rotten teeth and all, thought he was God. This placed him in a category with a fair number of street people, but whatever stereotypes that conjures, you may as well discard. For one thing, he wasn't a panhandler, nor was he, strictly speaking, down and out. In the summertime, he worked for the Pied Piper Ice Cream Company in Hawthorne, New Jersey, delivering good humor and sometimes numerical good news to children just across the state line in New York. This was the job that paid for his real work, the tens of thousands of numbers tracks he would bestow on anybody who cared and many who didn't. Nathan Chernikaw, Pied Piper owner, remembers.
He was my one real act of Christian charity. I said, what the devil can this guy do besides something of this nature at a job that was quite lucrative? I think he was earning $500, $600, $700, $800 a week. And this job also afforded him the opportunity to do his quote unquote quote work.
In the winter, he worked occasionally as a messenger, but mainly he concentrated on his numbers. The morning would find him in the Triangle Diner down the road from Pied Piper, hunkered down over a bowl of hot oatmeal, or in the evenings, a plate of veal parmigiana. Nadia Kopovchik waited on him for years.
He used to always, take a literature off in the paper first thing in the morning, then start writing things, scrabbling things. But I didn't know. Mostly he used to figure things with numbers, you know. But I have no idea, you know, what kind of theology or whatever he had. I have no idea.
Boys and girls, first thing off, we're going, instead of a senior play, we're going to start with a story today.
I know just, that one.
You know this one. But
Blum didn't have a home, but he did have an office, the Fairlawn, New Jersey Public Library. He was a fixture in the reading room there, working feverishly on his computations and serving up reference information when the employees themselves were stumped. There he made a friend of children's librarian Evelyn Schoenberg.
There were librarians here who were truly offended by him. Some of them who said, he's imposing himself upon us, and I don't see why he's here, because he would, okay, you know, he would come over and give you the sheet of paper. I mean, if you evinced any interest in what he was doing at all, and they would become annoyed if he did this more than once.
Mrs. Schoenberg indulged him because there was something about him underneath all that dishevelment that touched her.
He was a courtly man, and the thing that really made me feel very extremely warmly toward Mr. Blum was his ability to quote poetry, and he did it so beautifully. And very softly, one day, he began to quote William Blake's Songs of Innocence to me. And I was so deeply touched and so impressed that I forever was connected in a way to Mr. Blum in a very subtle way. I was so impressed with him.
Even in the ascetic spiritual life, of course, there are moments of earthly intrusion, such as the time Blum's daughter Marcia had some important news, At a loss for a way to reach him, she phoned the library.
She called to tell him, she called from Boston, to tell him that he had a grandson. Oh, this was a very poignant thing to have happen. We were all quite excited about it, actually. Even those who were not exactly, shall I say, friends of Mr. Bloom in the library were pleased that this happened. And even though they probably wanted to eject him and certainly to reject him, he was nevertheless a member of the family in the library.
Yes, Norman Bloom, self-described son of man, was also Norman Bloom, grandfather of Willie. It was just another tragic paradox in his life, for here was a man who so loved the world he sacrificed everything to serve it. But as the years went by, when it came to his own family, he became increasingly detached. The model of post-divorce visitation from the early 60s, whose regular weekend adventures inspired the Sunday song, referred in his prodigious writings to his own children not at all. He saw his grandchild Willie all of three times. Marcia Hulley recalls her father's first visit to her Boston home after Willie was born.
He came up to see Willie, and he had a little teddy bear. And I was so pleased, you know. I was so pleased that he thought of that, but you know what? It was Dottie at the ice cream truck who made it for Willie. It hurt. I don't know why it hurt.
It's not easy being a child of divorce, especially when Dad is a ridiculous vagabond whose quixotic ramblings mean continual embarrassment, aggravation, and fear. Fear for him and for the psychological future of you and your children. In some ways, Norman Bloom's journey for truth was paralleled by his daughter Marcia's. Was his sickness environmental, all Papa Bloom's fault, or genetic? Was his life, please, somehow romantic, or was it just pain? And did he, after he became ill, really and truly love her? With a flick of the wire cutters at a rented North Jersey storage locker, amid the musty clutter of soiled clothing and carton upon carton of arithmetical tracts, she searches for answers. Here, in a 6-by-9-foot cage, is the repository of Bloom's life's work.
What's this? Oh. What shark? What three-stage bomb? What fat frog? It's his ice cream order.
Marcia and her brother discard crates full of flyers and undelivered correspondence, one to John F. Kennedy, one to Yitzhak Shamir, one to Lawrence Taylor of the New York Giants. Presently, Marcia uncovers one of her father's journals, his last one, it seems.
This is something he said a lot. My bitterness is beyond any other bitterness. My agony is so profound, so limitless, completely rejected by the whole world. I made him some good meals.
Wish unfulfilled. She can find no letters from her, no photos of her, no references to her. A fact which, months later in Boston, she struggles to reconcile.
I know in my heart of hearts that my dad loved me very, very deeply. And I believe that I represented his link to normal life in a way. Because when he would come up here, I would give him dinner and we would listen to music, and it would be almost a day of normal life with love and compassion and
an emotional farewell.
He'd say goodbye, Pookat. He'd say, how much do I love you? I'd say, I love you zillions and zillions of big bunches of silches. Always. And do great things.
On the other hand, the visits were few, and he'd always veer into mathematical polemics. Even the tender departures were weighted with their mutual knowledge of his return to the street. In that final journal, Marcia found heart-rending documentation of his misery. Cold, upset stomach, no place to sleep, leg, take Pepto-Bismol, sleep in car, very ill.
Well, Norman neglected his health.
John Houston, a refrigeration mechanic at the Pied Piper Company.
September day, but the weather was below what was normal. It was a cold spell, and it was raining outside, and he, instead of going to a hotel, he just laid in the front seat of his car. I told him I think he'd be better off going to a hotel, but he didn't listen.
Nathan Chernikov.
There's nothing we could tell him. You can't tell God anything, you know. And he left the depot, not complaining of any illness or anything. Went on his route. I think it may have been about somewhere around 8 o'clock that we had gotten a call from local police. Children had come to his truck and saw him lying on the inside of his truck. They summoned the police, and they in turn, I believe, took an ambulance.
Here again, Larry King.
He did. Did he not get on our nerves and annoy us? And I almost felt like he was my shadow for some reason, but he became over the years a kind of integral part of this program. Norman Bloom passed away last night at Nyack Hospital in Nyack, New York. You know him or knew him as the numbers man.
In a life of manifold tragedy, maybe the most heartbreaking fact was the utter futility of Bloom's 26-year quest. His tireless accumulation of mathematical coincidences, according to astronomer Carl Sagan, was classically flawed. In a universe where there are trillions of simultaneous events that can be expressed with numbers, a few thousand such coincidences amount to a drop in the bucket. The genius behind such painstaking enumeration is undeniable, but in the end, it all amounted to nothing.
Oh, Daddy.
Coins, you
know. Oh, yeah, we have it here.
Bide your time for success is near.
Fortune cookie?
8863. Oh. Fortune cookie number. Oh, God. He always did love Chinese food. Okay. Empty.
This is your copy. Thank you very much. You can handle the rest.
Okay.
Thank you,
and I'm sorry about your dad. Thank you.
The search for Norman Bloom was told by writer Bob Garfield, an editor and columnist for Advertising Age.
It's All Things Considered.